The Day Shift podcast team is delighted to have partnered with ACP to bring you this special podcast episode on diagnostic decision making and considerations related to diversity, equity, and inclusion. This podcast episode is funded in part by the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation through a grant program administered by the Council of Medical Specialty Societies. Additional resources on this topic are available through ACP's Online Learning Center. Continuing medical education and maintenance of certification credits are also available as an ACP member benefit. The relevant links will be provided within the show notes. We hope you enjoy this rich and informative discussion. Thank you for listening.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of The Day Shift, where we talk about topics in diversity, equity, and inclusion. For me, it's a great pleasure to be your co-host for today's episode. My name is Ricardo Correa. I am an internal medicine physician and endocrinology specialist working for the Cleveland Clinic, where I'm the program director and the director for health equity and inclusive initiative for the institute. With me is Dr. Alicia Choi, that she will introduce herself.
Thank you, Dr. Correa. And as Ricardo said, my name is Alyssa Choi. I am absolutely delighted to be co-hosting this episode of The Day Shift on the topic of DEI in diagnostic decision making, along with my friend and colleague, Ricardo. And we have the distinct honor to be co-hosting an episode with two experts in this particular topic. And I'm delighted to introduce one of our two guests for today's episode, Dr. Denise Connor. Dr. Connor is a professor of clinical medicine and the gold-headed Kane Endowed Teaching Chair in Internal Medicine at UCSF. With her clinical home in the Faculty Hospital Medicine Division at the San Francisco VA Medical Center, a vital part of San Francisco's safety net. Dr. Connor began her career educational path as a chief resident based at the San Francisco VA. She later joined the Medicine Residency's Prime Program, where she served as associate director from 2013 to 2020. Dr. Connor designed and was the inaugural director of a novel capstone diagnostic reasoning course for pre-clerkship medical students at UCSF, starting with design in 2015 and leading the course through 2021. She was also the first chair of the Academy of Medical Educators Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee from 2017 to 2021. She is now the director of the School of Medicine's Anti-Oppression Curriculum Initiative. She is honored to collaborate with faculty, students, staff, and community members to elevate the School of Medicine's emphasis on justice, equity, anti-racism, and anti-oppression across the entire four-year curriculum.
Thank you so much, Alyssa. For me, it's a great honor to introduce Dr. Cristina Gonzalez. I know Dr. Gonzalez since many years ago, so really, really is an honor for me to introduce her. She is an alumni of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. She completed her internal medicine residency at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Weill Cornell Medical Center, and her medical education research fellowship at the University of Cincinnati, earning a master's degree in medical education. Upon completion of that fellowship, she was selected as a scholar in the Harold Amos Medical Faculty Development Program of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. This prestigious 4 years award launched her research program designing, implementing, and evaluating intervention aimed at implicit bias recognition and management in clinical encounters. She was subsequently selected as a scholar in the Macy Foundation Scholar Program of the Josiah Macy Jr. Foundation to continue advancing her work. Dr. Gonzalez is an international renowned expert in the development of skill-based curricular intervention in implicit bias recognition and management for physicians across the continuum of training and practice. In 2019, she transitioned from foundation funding and was awarded an NIH funding from the National Institute of Minority Health and Health Disparities. this grant provided 5 years of funding to design and validate novel metric facilitating future evaluation of intervention focused on IVRM with robust clinical relevant outcome metrics. In 2022, she was selected as a scholar in the National Academy of Medicine Scholar in Diagnostic Excellence Program. This funding mechanism will enable her to continue her work in IVRM through the lens of equity in diagnosis. She recently joined the New York University Grossman School of Medicine as a professor of medicine and population health and as an associate director for the Institute of Excellence in Health Equity. Welcome, Dr. Gonzalez and Dr. Connor. For us, it's a great, great pleasure, as we mentioned, to have you both here.
Dr. Connor and Dr. Gonzalez, it's really a delight to have you join us today. We usually refer to each other by first names to keep the atmosphere cordial and collegial. Would you mind if we used first names in introducing ourselves to each other and to yourselves?
Absolutely. That's great.
Perfect. Yeah, perfectly fine. Thanks.
Thank you so much. So given that our topic today is DEI in diagnostic decision making, I have some sense of what that might be, and likely Ricardo does as well. But as our two experts in this topic, I'd love to hear your thoughts about how you think about this topic and what that actually means to you. So perhaps I can start with you, Denise. What does DEI in diagnostic decision making mean to you? What is this topic about?
Well, thank you so much for having us. It's really a pleasure to be here to talk about this topic. You know, when I think about DEI and diagnosis, I specifically think about diagnostic equity. And when I think about that, I think about how do we acknowledge and reduce diagnostic disparities. There's not a great definition of diagnostic disparities that I've found in the literature, but building on some other definitions about just healthcare disparities with two colleagues, Bob Trowbridge and Verity Shea, we recently described diagnostic disparities as inequitable differences in the processes or outcomes of diagnostic care that are experienced by patients based on their social identities, economic, environmental, or structural factors. And I think that's really the heart of what we're trying to reduce when we're moving towards diagnostic equity.
Thank you so much for that answer. I want to continue the same question with you, Christina. All your work, intense work on implicit bias recognition and clinical encounters, what do you define as DEI in diagnostic decision making?
I'd also like to express my appreciation for the invitation to join the both of you today. And Ricardo, it's great to chat with you again. I want to take a moment to clarify that I will be talking about health equity, and I think we are talking about health equity. DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion is more, I'll just state my opinion is a workforce issue, right? In terms of having diversity, equity, and inclusion. I don't like to use the term for patients because then I worry that it sends the message that patients are white and everybody else is diversity. If we're talking about race or, you know, depending on the construct. And so for me, it is health equity, right? Patients are human and we want all patients to achieve the best possible health as well as healthcare outcomes. And so for me in health equity in medical decision making, I see it as eliminating the current disparities that we're seeing both in timeliness of diagnosis, accuracy of diagnosis, so having diagnostic error as opposed to diagnostic excellence, and also for thinking about the way that we communicate our diagnostic plan or diagnostic decision process to patients and families and their caregivers, very much in line with the National Academy of Medicine's definition. And so disparities refer to differences, as Denise was saying, differences that are they're unfair and they're avoidable, and so therefore they're unjust. Right? Differences are differences, but when outcomes are different and are actually avoidable, they become unjust and then in disparities. And so achieving health equity in medical decision making would be achieving diagnostic, in the realm of diagnosis, would be diagnostic excellence equitably across populations.
Christina, thank you for such an eloquent and thoughtful response. And as I listen to you really differentiate between health equity and DEI, I'm struck by the fact that they sometimes are used interchangeably, but words are important, words matter, and how we think about these concepts is also really critical. So appreciate you clarifying that when we're talking about this particular aspect of diagnostic decision-making, whether we're saying it's about DEI or not, it is really about health equity. So really appreciate you clarifying that. And I absolutely agree with how you stated that. So now that both of you have had a chance to give your perspectives on our topic for today and what we actually mean by it or what we think we mean by it, I'd love to hear a bit about your individual work and accomplishments in this area. So Denise, bringing it back to you, could you tell us a little bit about the work that you are doing in this area of disparities in health as it relates to diagnostic decision making?
Absolutely. So I think I appreciate everything Christina just said too. I think thinking about health equity is really what we're talking about. We're talking, if that's a big umbrella, then diagnostic equity is a small part of that larger pie. That was a lot of mixed metaphors there, but you know what I mean. What I was going to say is I am really an educator at heart. So when I think about my work in this area, it starts with a question that I had, which was, how do we teach students and trainees about the diagnostic process so that people can kind of have intentional opportunities to get towards excellence throughout their training and then move towards expertise throughout their career? When I was a trainee, we didn't really learn a lot explicitly about the diagnostic process. It was kind of a see it and then do it kind of a thing. And so I wanted to think about how to do that differently. And then on the other side of things, I've always been really interested in how to get towards health equity and how to reduce healthcare disparities. And sort of education was the lever that I've been trying to use to work on that issue. And of course, there's many different aspects from clinical care to research to implementation, et cetera, different things we all need to be doing to move towards health equity. But education is the area that I have expertise in. So that's sort of where I've tried to make that impact. And in my journey as an educator, I had the opportunity to have those two interests, the interest in diagnosis and the interest in health equity, kind of come together. Because as I was putting together this diagnostic reasoning course and looking at the diagnostic reasoning literature, I really found that there was a real emphasis on the cognitive internal aspects of the reasoning process. So things like a problem representation, an illness script, a diagnostic schema. We may have had other shows talking about the diagnostic reasoning process, which are all really, really important. But traditionally in the diagnostic reasoning literature, there wasn't as much of an emphasis on other things that impact the diagnostic process and our ability to get to the right diagnosis in a timely manner for patients. So I was sort of sad when I saw that there wasn't as much about that in the literature and began to try to do a little bit more digging to think about how could we talk with students about that aspect of the diagnostic process. And I would say over the last maybe 5 or so years, there has been more and more discussion and acknowledgement of the contextual nature of the diagnostic process, kind of moving away from this idea that it's just whatever is happening in the clinician's mind and acknowledging the fact that diagnostic processes are happening with entire teams. They're happening in communication between teams. They're related to the environment that we're in. There's really the sense that context matters increasingly and that teams matter, which is a really great kind of direction for the reasoning community. But even with that, there wasn't always the emphasis on, okay, but what happens when this doesn't go well? And so that's really the area that I've been most interested in thinking about. And I would say that in addition to the sort of this move towards contextualizing the diagnostic process and trying to teach students about that, there has been an increasing kind of amount of evidence in the literature that demonstrates various diagnostic disparities that has been really helpful so that we can really be specific about what we mean when we talk about diagnostic disparities. But I think there's a lot of work to do. So I guess as an educator, what I've been trying to do is think about, based on what we know from the communication literature and from the health equity literature and from healthcare disparities at large, what could we apply to the diagnostic process to help students begin to think about this topic? So that's where a lot of my work in this area has been focused. I've been thinking through a lot of literature review on sort of the communication, general healthcare communication literature. What are some of the sort of approaches to healthcare communication that could be applied to the diagnostic process with a goal of moving towards diagnostic equity? So I spent some time thinking about that and learning from experts in healthcare communication and thinking about those areas. And I'd love to talk more about that if that's of interest to folks. And then also thinking about what are the various barriers to diagnostic communication that get in the way of equitable diagnoses, and beginning to think about what might be strategies that we could employ to work against those barriers. And that's where people like Dr. Gonzalez come in as really full-blown researchers to help us think about how do we study some of these strategies and think more about that. But in the meantime, while there is a bit of a gap in some of this evidence, specifically around diagnosis, trying to share with students and learners what we do know and beginning to help people, encourage people to study this and think about it and to focus on it throughout their careers.
It's great to hear that education is vital in this topic. Just following this, I want to ask Christina about how those things and an implicit bias recognition and management that you have been studying for a long time, how can we relate that with the lens of health equity in diagnosis?
Excellent question. And I want to touch a little bit on Dr. Connor's point about the context and then spend the time talking about implicit bias recognition and management. And so it's interesting, every time I mention that I'm doing and that I'm moving more into the medical decision-making space, anybody who knows anybody immediately is like, oh, do you know Dr. Denise Connor? And so it's wonderful. In fact, it literally just happened today where I was talking to a colleague and they were like, oh, do you know Denise Connor? I'm like, well, I will be with her tonight. And so it's great to hear her perspective. And on the contextual factors are very important, and I won't repeat the things that Denise said nearly as elegantly as she did, but I wanted to add that the contextual factors do tie into implicit bias recognition and management in the thinking of that implicit bias is more likely to influence our clinical encounters when we're fatigued, when there's clinical ambiguity, when we're pressed for time, when there's interruptions. For example, you know, somebody coming in and telling your next patient is in a lot of pain, which of course is important, but can affect your thinking about the patient in front of you. And when you may have what's called social distance between you and your patient, meaning you don't know them very well, you may come from different backgrounds, have different shared, different lived experience, and do not share the same social identity on various constructs of social identities. And so the contextual factors are very, very important to address. And I very much admire the work that is ongoing in that sphere. And it ties into those implicit bias, into our implicit biases being activated or having us rely on those heuristics, right? The cognitive shortcuts that we end up jumping to when our brain is kind of in overload mode, if you will. And so as we work on the context in the clinical environment, I think that our work in implicit bias recognition and management, the framework that we've developed in our lab, is to be able to recognize when implicit bias is influencing an encounter. Either we did something, you know, or said something based on our assumptions that we made based on our implicit biases, or the patient's perceived bias based on what we think is an otherwise routine question or procedure based on their lived experiences with bias and discrimination, for example. Both of those, thankfully, we learned from our work with patients, both perceived bias on standard activities and actual bias, because we're human and we made an assumption, can be restored. And that's where the managing comes in, where you restore the encounter, you restore the rapport, you restore the relationship with your patient. And so we can implement skills to reconnect with our patients, to check in with our patients, to apologize when we made an assumption, and to acknowledge when something can be perceived as bias, and make sure that we're on the same page again with our patients so that we can demonstrate the respect that we do have for our patients. And so we've done a lot of work in the communication sphere for that. And more recently, through some work with the National Academy of Medicine Scholars and Diagnostic Excellence Program, I've been fortunate enough to be able to move into the diagnostic process. And we are looking at behaviors to achieve excellence more often for all of our patients. And our work in my lab works on, we created simulations. The technical term would be high fidelity simulations. And really what that's just medical education nerd speak for. We made standardized patient encounters, right? So clinical encounters are with actors that are recreate, that they are acting with the patient, with a physician. The physician is just being themselves. The actors are trained to portray the same case, and they're either black or white. In this case, for this case, they were black or white men, and they portray the same clinical scenario. And we've calibrated it with cognitive stressors, meaning that we have time constraints. We do have a nurse interruption. The case itself is very diagnostically, clinically ambiguous. It's a diagnostic challenge. And so what we're doing now, after we've seen that the outcomes for our black standardized patients, the medical decision-making is worse by the physician as compared to when they're seeing a white standardized patient. We're looking at those recorded videos and doing an interaction analysis, which is qualitative work where we see verbal and nonverbal behaviors, looking at inflection points of where people are going towards excellence and where they're going towards error. And although I could talk about this forever, I will be brief in stating that what we're looking at is a lot of his communication behaviors, you know, making empathic statements, which is a communication behavior. It's not a diagnostic behavior per se, actually allows more conversation, allows a better problem representation because you get a better history from your patient. You're able to listen to them, tell their story. And then one thing we're noticing very often is the opportunity for patient cues to be followed up on. Patients will say things like, not anymore, you know, perhaps for having taken a medicine. Oh, not anymore. Or can you walk without shortness of breath? Well, not anymore. And that means that it's new, right? And so that should be followed up on. And sometimes the communication piece of following our patient cues, as well as inviting them to say more by being empathic, can actually lead to a lot better medical It can lead to a lot better outcomes for the diagnostic process. That research is still pretty early, but we're really, really excited to move to build on our communications work and move into the diagnostic process space. And finally, I'll say that we work on a lot of interventions that are educational interventions to be able to provide us all with the skills to be able to connect with our patients and optimize the outcomes of our clinical encounters.
Thank you, Christina, for sharing all of your wonderful work. I was fascinated listening to what you do in your research and in setting up these simulation physician-patient scenarios. I had a quick question. You had alluded to some research you're doing right now in having differences looked at in patients who are white or black. I'm curious if your research will evolve to include other race or ethnicities or other potential factors that might lead to diagnostic disparities, such as patients or standardized patients, perhaps, that don't speak English as a first language or other factors that could impact the physician's ability to come to an accurate diagnosis.
I'm so glad you asked that question. Thank you for that. I think that, so the short answer is yes, but what I will explain is that, as I mentioned, our approach is skills-based and behavioral, meaning that it's different than other implicit bias research approaches where they may try to change your unconscious bias or your implicit bias. Oftentimes people may be familiar with the implicit association test. It's a free and online publicly available test of mental associations, basically. And people will do experiments to try to make your bias move. Let's say if it's pro-white based on your lived experience, just a coincidence of your lived experience, unconsciously, it'll just move it more towards neutral. That approach doesn't work. There's tons of data to show it doesn't work. And so with the skills-based behavioral approach, it's really just an aha moment, right? Oh, it's happening. Let me take a step back, think through this more purposefully, and implement the skills to deliver the excellent care I want to give in the first place. We've centered our work on race because up until, you know, 2020, it was really, nobody wanted to talk about race. It was very hard to get people to engage in conversations with that. And I thought, well, if we can figure this out for race, then we can figure it out for other constructs. And so And so the good news is that it is our preliminary data are showing that it is transferable across constructs such as gender. We've done it in work in obesity. And so, because let's say just one last quick example. Let's say I'm the patient. If I'm your patient and we're doing okay, we're talking, you know, I'm giving you the history, we're answering, we might be laughing a little bit, everything's going well. And then suddenly something changes in my demeanor. You don't know. And I'll just use myself as an example. You don't know if that's because I identify as female, I'm Catholic, you know, my religion is Catholic, my BMI is blank today, or you know what I mean? So you don't have to actually guess or know. There won't be separate interventions per se for various parts of our intersectional identities. It's that suddenly the vibe has changed and you can stop, as if you were my physician, you could stop and check in, right? And pause and make sure that we reset and reconnect regardless of why I may have perceived bias in that moment.
Wow, Christina, that was a lot. And I loved listening to it. I felt like I got a crash course in all of the work that you're doing. And I'm really excited to hear that there may be a way to scale that out in different models based on some of the research you're doing right now. So thank you so much for sharing all of that. And I love the idea of having it be more of a skills-based approach. I have taken the implicit association test, and while I find it valuable, I also can understand some of the limitations. So it's great to hear some of the work that you're doing. Denise, you had talked a bit earlier about your work and your role as an educator, and I was intrigued by a couple of the comments that you made and wanted to see if you could embellish and flesh that out a little bit for us. You had talked about healthcare communications and some of the contextual factors. And I'm thinking about an editorial that you had shared with us a while back and talking about diagnostic disparities, where you highlighted how there was definitely some diagnostic disparities in the diagnosis of acute coronary syndrome based on whether the patients were black or white, and some more delayed diagnoses of appendicitis in children who are black, and various other diagnostic disparities. So as I thought about your initial comments about healthcare communications and contextual factors, I also recognize that we don't make these diagnoses in a vacuum, and so many things, including the communications between the teams, the context in which we're seeing the patients, could all factor into whether we make an accurate diagnosis. So with all of that as a backdrop, I'd love to hear your further thoughts about how all of this interplays into ultimately impacting disparities in diagnosis.
Thank you for that question. It's such a complicated system when you think about the diagnostic process, and Christina and her team's work looking at sort of some in the lab, what's happening in these interactions is teaching us and has so much potential to teach us some strategies to mitigate some of the issues that pop up in these types of communication. I think the first thing I'll say is when I was a trainee, people often said something like, you know, most of the diagnosis is in the history. And I have definitely found in practice that that is true. Certainly, we get data, we get additional data when we do a physical exam and we get labs and imaging, but really it's the history of the patient that helps us to even begin to imagine what could be going on with them. And so it's really easy to think about how our communication is going to directly impact that history. And there was a really interesting paper, it was quite a while ago now, in 2006, by Heritage and Robinson in Health Communication, where they were looking at something as simple as what kind of first question was asked in a encounter and how long a problem representation was after that. And when the inquiry was a general inquiry, an open-ended question, people gave much more information than if it started with a confirmatory closed-ended question, like, I understand you're having sinus problems. You're going to get much less from a patient than if you say, tell me about what brought you in today. Because you're giving them some control in the conversation to take it where they want to take it, and not to just to answer your very specific closed-ended question, but to ask a really a bigger question, and gives them the space and the sort of empowerment to give you more information. And that's such a basic idea. We teach students all the time that we need to ask open-ended questions at the beginning of a history, but there is a whole literature that suggests why that's true. And I think what you have to layer on top of that is sort of what Christina was beginning to talk about, which is the background and identity, the social identities of the clinician and the patient are layered on top of that. And sometimes that interaction, the types of questions that are asked might be different in an inequitable way based on do we share social identities with our patients? And there was in this study looking at urban health centers versus other health centers. In these urban health centers, folks were asking more closed-ended questions than in other centers. And it's really interesting to imagine that the types of questions we ask and the way we ask them might differ depending on the context we find ourselves. And you could imagine what a powerful tool would be to give people feedback about, are you being equitable in how you ask patients questions? Or are you seeing differences between patients based on their background identities? So just the basic idea is that the communication piece is so critical to diagnosis, and that even very basic communication strategies that we all know, we actually don't apply equitably all the time. And how do we work against that? In addition to thinking about communication strategies that are important to kind of elicit a full story, a full kind of illness story from a patient, you can also think about what are some of the barriers that are in the room even before you open your mouth that we could be thinking about how to mitigate. Because as Christina was talking about with implicit bias, it's hard to get rid of implicit bias, unfortunately, but we can try to mitigate the impact of implicit bias on our patients. So I think that's another area that's really interesting. And as I was doing some of my reading in the communication world and in the world around health equity, one topic that really stuck out to me was this idea of health-related stereotype threat. I think many of us are familiar with the concept of stereotype threat in general. So this sense that, and you know, the early studies were in young kids, specifically girls, taking math tests, and how when gender was primed, those students knew there were stereotypes about girls not being good at math, and so they did less well on the math test because of that. So that has been expanded to many other settings, including the healthcare setting. There's a really wonderful book by Tina Sachs called Invisible Visits. She talks about a lot of experiences of Black women in the healthcare setting, not specifically just talking about diagnosis, but in general. And that was a really helpful book for me when I was thinking about this idea of health-related stereotype threat, because she gives some very clear examples of how that gets in the way of communication and people's access to excellent care. And so if we know that patients are coming into the healthcare context aware of stereotypes that exist in the setting related to a social identity that they hold, that can impact the communication between the patient and the clinician. In particular, many patients will try to adjust their behavior to mitigate that stereotype threat. And that can sometimes get in the way of the full illness story being expressed. And you can imagine how that can have downstream effects on the ability to get to an accurate diagnosis. So as we think about that topic of health-related stereotype threat, I'm really excited by folks like Christina who are in the lab who can give us strategies for how to reduce that, the impact of that on the encounter and on the diagnostic process.
Thank you so much, Denise, for that amazing insight on multiple things. One on communication, because I think that this is key when we talk about diagnostic decision making. And the second thing is about the health-related stereotype threat that affect us and our patients, and these kind of things needs to be mitigated. I really like and enjoy how the different parts of this podcast, one focusing a lot on the education part, the other focusing a lot on the production of the data. But I have a question for both of you, starting with you, Denise, is what are the challenges that you are seeing in translating all of this to the common clinical practitioner out there in the community?
That is such a good question, because we know what it's like to be a clinician. It's incredibly busy. And especially, I guess the COVID pandemic is now, I don't know if it's really finished, but it's taken a toll on many of us. So I think if you think about it, you have a burned out group of folks trying to do their very best in very busy settings. It is important to think about how can we provide tools to get towards equity that actually are going to be able to be used by folks that are in that kind of a context. So coming back to your question, we need to be really clear with why we are asking folks to do things differently. When we're asking them to do things differently, we need to explain to folks, you know, the reasoning behind that. We think about disparities as, you know, one of the biggest healthcare issues of our time. We want to make sure that we're connecting clearly with that as the focus. I think sometimes when we talk about communication skills, people will say, oh, those are sort of touchy-feely skills. They're not really what we need to do is just like, you know, do our jobs and not worry about spending time on some of the fluff. But I think what is important to recognize is that communication skills, actually advanced communication skills, can really be huge when it comes to diagnostic disparities. And so it is worth our time. That said, I think we can't expect individual clinicians to do this alone. I think they need institutional support to do this. And some ideas that I've heard discussed out there are beginning to advocate for thinking about folks who come from backgrounds where they may have experienced healthcare discrimination, beginning to advocate that those folks need longer visits. So when we think about equity, we want to give people what they need to get towards diagnostic accuracy. And that might be depending on a patient's background and prior experiences with healthcare. So if institutions really believe in the importance of equity and want to reduce disparities, it might mean that some patients, you know, visits need to change. Similarly, we can think about healthcare advocates and supports for patients who are coming into healthcare contexts where they've had negative experiences in the past, and thinking about whether institutions would support healthcare advocates for patients who have had those experiences that could support those patients in sharing their full illness story during a visit. So I think some of it has to do with getting clinicians excited and motivated about why these skills really matter to reduce disparities. And some of it has to do with what kind of institutional and systems level changes can we put in place to actually support clinicians in doing this work. Because certainly it can't only happen on an interpersonal level. It has to happen on a systems level.
Ricardo, that was a great question. And Denise, thank you for your comprehensive and very eloquent response. I wonder if I could direct the same question to Christina. And I'd be curious also to hear your thoughts about how all of the wonderful research you're doing in the lab, how can that ultimately translate and improve the care that the frontline physician and clinician will be providing to their patients?
So I agree. I think we're asking physicians to do more and more, and sometimes it feels like with less and less. And I think if we are able to build on Denise's point about explain the why. We all want to take excellent care of our patients. And when we're actually empowered with skills to do things, I think that helps it get more buy-in, right? Because nobody wants to hurt anybody on purpose. And so we end up showing the problem, but not giving any skills. And so I think that what we're trying to do is find digestible, efficient ways to integrate the skill building into usual clinical workflows with as minimal disruption as possible. And that leads then to what we're working on in our research. And so currently we have a set of interventions that, that faculty physicians have participated in, and they like them. The satisfaction scores are high. They actually can build skills in role play settings. And we currently have a grant under review, so fingers crossed, at the NIH, where we are looking to now test that intervention, the efficacy of it, with our simulations that I was mentioning earlier, actually use the outcomes of the simulation to test the efficacy of that intervention. Once we have that intervention, we can demonstrate the efficacy of the intervention. We'll be able to find the most effective and efficient components so we can streamline it, and then also be able to practice in actual patient care settings. Because I need to stress how important it is to do this work in a simulated setting first. There have been a lot of unintended consequences for research approaches and implicit bias. Denise was mentioning stereotype threat before, and it's a really great point. I want us to think about it also on the side of the clinicians. So this is, as clinicians, we're afraid of hurting people. And so if we find out that we may have bias, for example, against Black people at an unconscious level, right, an implicit bias, not on purpose, the data show that people will actually maybe avoid Black people or Black patients because they don't have the skills and are afraid, now that they know about this bias, of hurting people. And so those types of unintended consequences can hurt patients if we roll interventions out too quickly and people are practicing new skills with actual patients, right? We don't want that. So we practice in the simulated setting and then we'll be able to integrate them into the clinical setting. And my dream is to be able to streamline these interventions. And sure, it'll take some time for training in the clinical setting, but if we can partner with health economists, for example, and do cost effectiveness analysis and show that if we can take a little bit of time away from making RVUs to actually participate in skill building to ultimately take better, excellent, more equitable care of our patients, the patients will of course have better outcomes, which is our primary goal. We'll feel better as physicians, and we'll hopefully be able to get system buy-in from the system to be able to engage in some time in skill building.
Thank you so much, Christina, for sharing that part. I think that, as I mentioned, the correlation here between with the data that can be produced in research and how can we translate that to the clinical practice, and how can we educate the next generation and the actual generation that is practicing to make better the sense of equity in diagnosis is incredible. I want to ask you, Denise, about what are your final thoughts on this topic, and what is your wish list that things should be happening in the next upcoming year so we can achieve that really equity in diagnostic decision making?
That's such a great question. I love the idea of our wish list. I think a couple of things I'll say is we're seeing more and more research coming out that is demonstrating diagnostic disparities, as we discussed at the beginning of our time. And I think that's important, of course, because to get funding and to get a focus on the research that's needed, we need to demonstrate what the problem is. But my wish list is that as we go forward, we begin to focus more on strategies and mitigation solutions, and that we see a lot more research that helps us to begin to work against this problem, because I think we have now a lot of data that demonstrates the problem. So that's one thing I'd like to see in the research world, is moving towards thinking about solutions. And when we do that, I'm really hoping, and this is something that I wrote about with my colleague Gurpreet Dhaliwal, which is there's a whole big literature about community-based or community-led research, community participatory research in many realms when it comes to clinical research. And I really would love to see that approach applied in this realm, because it is going to be very hard, I think, for researchers who are really isolated in the academy to identify and develop solutions without really thinking about our patients as our core partners in this work. So that's something I hope to see in the research arena. I think for clinicians, when I like the thinking about the levels, the ways that we can address disparities comes in a number of levels. We can think about the intrapersonal level. What can I do to work on myself to get better? Personal level, what can I do in my communication and my interactions with my patients, their families, and my colleagues? And then the systems, institutional and societal level. And I would be so excited if clinicians all over could think about, are you able to identify something that you can do at each of those levels? Because I think all of those are going to be needed for us to move towards healthcare equity, especially diagnostic equity. And if we all were able to identify one, you know, actionable thing we could do in each of those domains, that would be very exciting. I can share just a couple of small things in each of those levels that people could think about, but I think it's important for people to consider their particular context and where they see the biggest needs as they begin to identify what their goals are. You know, on the intrapersonal level, I think it's a lot about understanding our own unconscious bias, understanding the history and the context of healthcare, and learning, if you don't know a lot yet about diagnostic disparities, learning what they are, just sort of developing a little bit more information and expertise in that realm. And that's sort of what we're doing today, right? In the interpersonal level, I do think communication skills, as we've been talking about, are so important. And I'll just name a couple of them. that I think could be very accessible to clinicians. I will say I'm biased because I'm currently doing a fellowship through the Academy of Communication in Healthcare. So their relationship-centered model of communication, I think, is a really powerful approach to equitable diagnostic communication, or could really be something that folks could start with. I think many of us as practicing clinicians, we've been communicating with our patients for many years, but it's amazing if you take some, you know, time for advanced training, sort of how you can refresh and build your skills. So I think thinking about what kind of advanced communication training is available at your institution, and if there isn't anything, then you can think about the systems and structural level. Can you advocate for that? Is that something your institution could be providing in a way that does make it accessible to you and your colleagues? So what kind of advocacy can we be doing about advanced communication training is another kind of option for us to think about. And the last thing I will add is, in order to work on these issues, we need to understand what they are. So looking at your institution and making sure that your individual institution is actually collecting data that's going to help you to identify when diagnostic disparities are happening, that's really the first step in order to address them. So is your institution collecting data about diagnostic outcomes? And is it doing so in a way that disaggregates that data based on the social identities of the different folks coming to see you? That's really important. And if that's not happening, that's another opportunity for institutional advocacy. So there's a lot, and I know everyone's plates are very, very full, but this work is really fulfilling because it is so important and it aligns with all of our values to relieve suffering and to make sure that everyone gets the care that they need to get an accurate diagnosis and move towards treatment. So I hope that people will think about, is there something in one of those realms that they might lean into? So I just wanted to add one thing to what we were talking about. I loved the question about, you know, broadening from into other aspects beyond race and ethnicity. And when we're talking about equity and diagnostic equity, and I just wanted to name out loud how many different social identities likely are linked with disparities and the amount of work that's needed in many other areas outside of race and ethnicity. And some of the things I'll mention are gender. Gender is really thought about in this binary way that's not helpful for many patients, and imagine how that can impact the diagnostic process, and also how gender can be confused with sex and sort of biologic characteristics and sort of the ways that that can impact the diagnostic process. The other area that I think is really critical for us to think about is folks who have disabilities and how disabilities may impact the diagnostic process. We certainly know there are disparities in other areas of clinical care when it comes to disability. So just wanted to really echo that point that there are so many different communities and identities that we need to be thinking about when we try to move towards equity in diagnosis.
Thank you, Denise. That was wonderful to hear your concluding comments and wish list. And I loved how you broke down how we can make efforts in this area of minimizing and hopefully eradicating diagnostic disparities through those three different levels as an individual, and then the interpersonal, and then the larger society at large. Christina, I wanted to turn a similar question to you that Ricardo asked Denise, and ask you as well what you may want to conclude with after this really wonderful, robust discussion we've had. What are some concluding thoughts? What are some concrete action steps that our practicing frontline physicians and clinicians can take away, and what might be your wish list?
I think that to add to Denise's fantastic wish list, this is not an or, this is definitely an and. I would hope that we can turn implicit bias recognition and management through looking at the diagnostic process and reaching diagnostic excellence and medical decision-making equity into a team sport. And meaning that as we work on these interventions and as we work on developing skills, and you can have some sort of training in the team setting, but we can also normalize having these discussions. Part of the problem is that it's a little bit emotionally charged, potentially. It kind of goes against our core as good people doing the very best we can to take care of patients, to realize that we might be providing inequitable care. And so we're taking care of patients sometimes in very complicated clinical situations in terms of the clinical presentation itself, in very busy and at times rather chaotic clinical environments. And so if we could normalize discussing bias processing and debriefing instances, and it doesn't have to just be implicit bias, but instances where we're seeing potentially inequitable care being delivered, or maybe we notice that our colleague is cutting off a patient more often, you know, maybe they're cutting off older patients or they're cutting off Black patients, interrupting them, if you will, more often than other patients. It'd be so great if we could discuss that in a way that is safe and respectful, because I think until we get more skill-based interventions out into the world, I think it's going to be hard for us to notice when we're doing it ourselves. But I think it's sometimes easier if you're not the one doing the diagnosing and the history taking and all the thinking in that moment. I think it's easier if you're can see somebody else perhaps behaving differently with certain patients than they do with other patients, if we can talk about it. And I liken it to having we used to call it, when I worked at my old institution in the hospital medicine group, we had a bunch of desks and I loved working in that space. It was like 11 of us sometimes at a time in this big room with computers. And I called it the I Got a Guy consult. And basically we just kind of leaned back and be like, you know, I got a guy. And yes, there were definitely women at times, but whoever wasn't that busy leaned back or rolled their chair over and was like, go ahead. And you would present the case and you'd brainstorm through it. And never did any of us think, ooh, they're going to think I'm a bad doctor if I ask this question or run this case by them and they figure something out that I don't, right? I loved being able to roll my chair over to help. And I loved when they rolled their chair over to help me. And so wouldn't it be great if we could either discuss it when we see it, or even if I could say, hey, you know, I had this encounter today and the vibe was off. You know, can I run this by you? And not have you worry and not worry that you may think I'm racist or that you may think I'm a bad person because I exhibited bias or didn't pick up when the patient perceived bias. And I think that again, I'm not saying that implicit bias is the magical solution to our diagnostic inequities. I'm just, as given that that's the sphere that I work in and the skill development kind of clinical tools and our clinical toolbox that I want us to encourage to have, I would love to normalize these conversations and help us just get to a better place of excellence in our patient outcomes and our relationships with patients and support each other in that process in a safe and respectful way.
Well, it was so nice and so enlightening to hear both of you talking about this topic. I think that there's so much learning that personally I got, and I know that all the listeners will get when they finish this recording, because it's so much things that are happening, and there are other things that will happen if we continue moving the needle through equity and using that specifically in diagnosis decision making. So with this, I really want to thank Christina and Denise for the amazing time that we spent today talking about this topic. I know that it's not easy for anyone, but you are moving and you're making the change to the world, and we really appreciate that. We also want to thank all the listeners of the podcast, because this is for all of you, so you can get more knowledge and more experience on this kind of things that we do here.
Thank you, Ricardo, for your concluding wrap-up thoughts, and I will echo everything that you said and give my deep appreciation to Dr. Denise Connor and Dr. Christina Gonzalez, our two esteemed guests for this podcast episode. I am sure our listeners will feel that they learned a great deal. I know I feel like my knowledge in this area increased exponentially 100-fold just by listening to their expert commentary on all of these issues as it pertains to diagnostic disparities. And I also want to thank all of our listeners of The Day Shift. Your continued engagement with the topics that we present has really sustained and energized all of us who spend our time in making some of these podcast episodes. And also thank you, Ricardo. It's been a pleasure co-hosting this episode with you. And thank you to Aaron and Nikhil and other staff who support technically all of these episodes. So this is just the start of the conversation. The podcast is a springboard for further discussions. And as both of our guests had alluded to, you can start just from yourself and then gradually expand the circle of who you try to influence so that we can achieve more diagnostic equity in diagnostic decision making. So please use this as just the starting point and not the end of the conversation. And feel free to check out the transcript after the episode and also look for bibliography and references for additional ways that you can continue the learning. And as always, thank you for joining us on The Day Shift.
The Day Shift podcast and its guests provide general information and entertainment, but not medical advice. Before making any changes to your medical treatment or execution of your treatment plan, please consult with your doctor or personal medical team. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by The Day Shift. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the podcast does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by the Day Shift team are those of each individual and do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the Day Shift team and its guests, employers, sponsors, or organizations we are affiliated with. The Day Shift podcast is proudly sponsored by the American College of Physicians Southern California Region 3 chapter. Our theme music is brought to you by Chris Dingman. Learn more at www.chrisdingman.com.